I will hit the record button. Thank you everybody for attending the bi-weekly IRSA meeting. Please follow the code of conduct and the antitrust policy. If you aren't familiar with those, please view them on the Hyperledger site, but I think everybody probably is. Do we have anybody new that wants to introduce themselves today?
Hey, sorry Derek, to interrupt hey, you.
You're sounding like very faint.
Mic, maybe.
Really? Oh. Can you hear me now?
A little better.
Awesome. Okay. I'm a finance student from McMaster University. I'm relatively new to blockchain, and I'm looking forward to helping out with anything in regards to IRSA, in regards to product management, and potentially programming. So yeah.
Great. Thanks. Nice to meet you. And yeah, feel free to reach out to people if you have questions.
Awesome. Thank you.
Anyone else? I guess you scared them all away, Dan. If not, then I would like to turn the floor over to Alex. Alex, you're there. Can you hear us?
Yep, I can hear you.
Great. Would you like to talk?
Yeah, sure. Let me share my screen. Okay, can everybody see my screen?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Cool. Thanks, Art. So, basically, well, first of all, I would like to thank Hart and everyone in this group to, you know, give me the opportunity to present. I'm learning these myself as well. Originally, I just sort of like challenged myself to force myself to give a presentation so that I tried so that I would read the paper and finished it on time. And so after work today, I put up a simple kind of notes or presentation or slides, whatever you call it. But I don't have the time to do it a trial run. So if I messed up in the middle, just forgive me. And also because I'm learning these myself, so if I made any mistakes or anything, any clarification you want me to make, just you know, stop me anywhere. So I guess the rough agenda for today is mostly the motivation. We'll be talking about growth, Sahai proof. GS proof. And motivation, and also where is it in the, you know, universe of zero knowledge proof systems. I think this is a very important one, because as I'm like reading through the literature, I feel like there are so many zero knowledge proof systems that can be baffling, you know, to understand, you know, why am I even reading this paper? Why am I even looking at growth Sahai proof? And then we go over some, you know, basics, definition, and we will have a warm-up proof systems, which is basically, I'll recapitulate what Groth himself presented during one of the winter school in Israel, and then finally give some intuition of the final GS proof system. And if we have time and adopt it, we can skim through some of the paper, the paper itself. Okay. All right. So the first thing is the motivation for this proof system. When I read this title, this sharing or this presentation is more of like my digestion of this paper and whatever that I have read over the past few weeks or so. So it can be less organized. It wouldn't look like what Groth himself presented. Forgive me on that. So when we're looking at this title, right, it's efficient non-interactive proof systems. So the first is the important part is it's a non-interactive proof system. Well, the idea of interactive proof systems, or the amount of communication that we need to, in order to prove a theorem, this idea through interaction was initially, the inception is from Goldwasser, Michali, and Rakoff in 85. So that's the first paper who, you know, present a zero knowledge proof system. And then later on, you know, later paper also, so basically in this proof systems, right, there is a prover and there's a verifier. And the prover is trying to prove something non-trivial, hopefully, right? If it's trivial, then verifier could you know, compute or derive that himself. For example, he wants to prove that certain value is a quadratic residue. That's one of the examples given by the original paper. And through rounds of interactions and, you know, you can think of this as a question and answer, the verifier will be convinced that such instance belongs to a certain language. Later on, the GMW 86 paper proved that for all language in MP, you can devise a zero knowledge proof systems. So where does this non-interactive come from? So the first non-interactive zero knowledge proof system was proposed by Baum, Fred Fettman, and Michali in 88. So their idea is to examine three of the most important components in the 85 paper by Goldwasser. So they say that in this interactive zero knowledge proof system, there are three components that are important. One is interaction. The second is the randomness for the verifier, because the verifier is asking question. These are like asking question, and the prover is giving answers. So this type of it's just like how teachers and students are interacting, and teacher is sort of imparting this knowledge to the students, right? And in order to have the zero knowledge properties, the private coin from the verifier. I think it's mostly the soundness property, which we'll explain in a little bit. The private coin for the verifier is kind of important. And the third one is that for the zero knowledge property to hold, whatever the answer that the prover gives has to have some kind of computational difficulty in the proof. So for example, in the original examples, right, if I try to prove that certain integer is a quadratic residue, the simplest way I can convince you is just to give you the root of that of x, right? I can just give you the root of x, but that would just defeat the purpose of zero knowledge because you would knew that as well. Somehow in my answer, I have to embed some kind of computational difficulty that the verifier couldn't derive, just directly derive the answers or the witness that the prover has directly from like interacting with the prover. So I guess in this 88 paper, the question that they ask is, can we eliminate the first two elements of this components? So basically they don't want interaction, and also they want to have like a public coin instead of a private coin. Public coin meaning like a randomness that everybody have access to. So what they came up with is what we now normally know as the common reference string, or at the time they use common random bits, right? And so using this common random bits, they are able to devise a non-interactive proof system. So that was the beginning of non-interactive zero knowledge proof system. And another approach or techniques that we see a lot in these like zero knowledge proof system papers is Fiat-Shamir transform. Which is a heuristic that take any interactive zero knowledge proof system and generically transform it into a non-interactive proof systems just by relying on the a hash function or random oracle. We imagine it as a random oracle, and instead of the verifier really asking the question, the prover would just generate the queries, assuming that we have a random oracle or a truly random function. It's the actual queries are unpredictable, so that in a sense it's similar. So that's how they like generically transform interaction to non-interaction. So that's the idea of that's the non-interactive non-interactive proof system, roughly. And then the second part is efficient, right? Efficient really comes from, from efficient means that previously, right, Growth and Sahai is looking at existing zero knowledge proof system, and they realize a lot of them are not efficient. And there are two sorts of inefficiency that they pointed out in the paper. One is that when we try to prove some non-trivial language in MP, and preferably outside BPP, what we're doing usually is that you are doing a MP reduction, right? You're reducing certain MP statements, and you try to reduce it to a MP complete language, like a circuit satisfiability. And this reduction usually is like very, very expensive. So this huge blow up would make the proof generation very, very expensive. So they are not really efficient. And this paper, or this GS proof, is trying to work around that problem. And just to remind you, like some of the other MP complete, right? So we have the polynomial P, and those which can be solved in polynomial time, and MP, which is preferably most of the more relevant to us. A lot of the crypto systems and statements would be lies in MP, and usually you will have a reduction. For example, this is Elgamal encryption statements for Elgamal encryption, and usually you would in the previous zero knowledge proof system, what they do is they will reduce that to like one of the MP complete problem, like three coloring or Hamiltonian cycle or three satisfiability, things like that. The reason why they want to do this reduction, of course, is that if you can prove that the system works for any MP complete problem, then it means that any language in MP could use your proof system to generate a zero knowledge proof system. So that comes. So the next is the next thing comes to the actual motivation. So Growth and Sahai was thinking, okay, so if this thing, if this reduction has a huge blow up, right? If it is expensive, then can we get rid of this MP reduction to circuit satisfiability? And so they look at a lot of the, common things that we try to prove in the cryptographic protocols or cryptographic systems. So for example, one typical example would be like we try to prove that the plaintext of X is a signature of M, right? Something like that. And usually these elements X or M, right? The lies in certain groups, right? These statements usually involve group elements or group operations, right? Let it be integers, or let it be groups over elliptic curves, whatever have you, right? So the epiphany moment is that instead of using circuit satisfiability, they're thinking of using like a group dependent language, right? So they do not want to reduce statement like this to circuit satisfiability. What they want to do instead is reduce the statements to group independent language, which means that this reduction is already kind of native. So it wouldn't be very expensive. So that was kind of the idea. And the first time when I read this group independent language, I wasn't sure what does it mean. Because I've never seen that before. And I guess it goes back to the definition of language, right? Language is just a set of statements that, for example, returns true on the decision problem. Like, for example, on the satisfiability instance, right? You could say that the input x1, x2, x3, blah, 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 like if they belong to, if we assign value to all of these variables, and the output of this first order logic, the output of this formula would be, for example, one, right? And any inputs to these variables would be belongs to this language. So, and any assignments to all of these variables that makes the formula output one would belong to this language. This is a kind of a decision problem. And for this group in, group-dependent language, right, it's still, so my interpretation of it was that it's still a satisfiability problem. But instead of this logic, right, it's satisfied, the group-dependent language is satisfiability for a list or array of equations. So what equations? Well, there are three equations proposed by them. One is the pairing product. Second is multi-exponentiation. The third is quadratic equations. And we'll go into a little bit more detail later on, and in terms of why these three types of equations, right? So of course, when I see this, right, when I understand this, what group-dependent language is, the next three question that naturally derives from that understanding is that, first of all, why those three types? And second, is there a concrete example of something expressed in those equations? And the third is it as powerful, as expressive as a circuit satisfiability? Because if this language is significantly more trivial than circuit satisfiability, then proving something in this group-dependent language wouldn't be as universal or as useful as it could be. Right. So, in other words, would all the language, you know, that satisfy the all the equation, would also can we also derive a zero knowledge proof for it? Okay. Oh, okay. So, wait. A quick answer to these questions is that the reason why we need these three types is that these three types encompasses most of the statements that we encountered in a cryptographic systems, and we'll show you later on, and we'll show you in the examples in the warm-up proof systems in the coming slides. And the question, as if it is as powerful as a circuit satisfiability problem, yes, it is. And the reduction, we can go over the reduction if we have time, but the simple answer is yes. So anything that you can prove, if you can construct a zero-knowledge system for this language, then you can construct a system for any language in MP. All right. Just before going forwards, at this point, I think it's important to reflect that, while there is a lot of other many proof systems, right? We heard the terms like SNARK, you know, Pinocchio, growth 10, growth 16, so many proof systems. And the natural question to ask is, where does this GS proof sits, right? Right, there's just way too many. And why am I even looking at this? So to understand the position of GS proof in this wild ZK proof universe, we have to go over some basic definition. So I'm sure that this will be a little bit repetitive to many of you, since many of you probably already know. So bear with me, just to make sure everyone is on the same page. So the definition of zero knowledge proof systems, right, is that so what we're trying to prove is we try to prove that a certain statement belongs to the language, right? Sometimes it is also equivalent to saying that, you know, there exists a witness, such that this input and witness is belongs to MP relations, right? Well, it's just a fancier way to say that. And I guess that's the basic definition from like undergraduate complexity class. Like we said, the prover is trying to prove the statements to the verifier. The verifier can ask questions, and all of them would know the instance that prover is trying to prove. Sometimes the prover has the witnesses, but not necessarily. So there are three important properties for any zero knowledge proof systems. I think hard ask question to Dan or to someone many calls ago about the definition of all of these three. So the first one is completeness. So what completeness means is that if X really belongs to L, so actually belongs to L, this is something that prover is trying to prove. Then the probability of these interactions, right, the probability that the prover would convince V is almost one. So which means that if E equals to one, it means perfect completeness, right? Soundness means that if a malicious prover, meaning that either he doesn't have the witness, right, to prove the statements, or he's reacting randomly and doesn't want to give the right proof to the verifier, right? So if this X doesn't belong to the language, so if certain statement doesn't belong to the language, the concrete example is if a X doesn't belong to a quadratic residue, right? It doesn't have a root, then the probability of this prover to convince B is negligible, right? With respect to certain security parameters, right? So basically what completeness and soundness means is that completeness is if X really belongs to language, if it is true, then I can convince you almost absolutely. If it is not true, right, the soundness means I could not cheat, right? I can't convince you I cannot convince something is not true, right? That's completeness and soundness. And the third properties is the more novel ones, right? Zero knowledge properties means that for all the statements, there exist the simulators who can simulate the interactions between the real prover and the real verifiers. And I use the notation here. So the simulator S, so you can imagine this. So the S is interacting with V. So the idea of zero knowledge is that the verifier doesn't get anything other than the truth of the statements, right? He couldn't derive anything out. And how do we formalize this idea of zero knowledge? What Goldwasser and his co-authors propose is that we can imagine that if we have a random simulators who doesn't have the witness like the prover does. However, he could simulate the interactions between the verifier, right? He can simulate the interaction between the verifier and output, the script, we call it the view or the script of these interactions. And if it is the distribution of this script is almost similar or the same as the interaction between the real prover and the real verifier, then we could say that the verifier learns nothing. Okay, I'll say that again. The reason why is that the simulator doesn't have the witness, right? The simulator doesn't have the witness. So through this interaction, the verifier couldn't learn anything about the witness, right? So that's how they formalize the zero knowledge proof properties. Okay.
So Alex, great talk so far. I just want to point out for everybody's emphasis that the simulator doesn't have to exactly play the protocol. It just has to produce the transcripts.
Right. Yes. And usually this is a technical thing if we we'll try to really prove it, is that the simulator usually are given more power, like some special power. For example, if you can rewind the tapes of when it's trying to interact with this verifier. But that's, I guess, technical issues that we don't have to cover. Yeah. So other than those three main properties that we heard all the time, there are another two that's relevant in this GS proof papers. One is knowledge soundness. So sometimes we not only want soundness, we also want to make sure that the prover actually have the witness. The reason why, for example, there could be the case where proving an X belongs to language can be very trivial. For example, if L is just a multiplicative group, and the statement basically is saying that I have any random elements from this multiplicative group, and I say that it has a inverse. Well, that's trivially true, because every element in this multiplicative group have an inverse. Let's say a prime group, right? Because everyone has a group. So that's not something that you need any witness to prove, because it's trivial. So And the knowledge soundness is a stronger notion of soundness, where the definition, well, I guess is slightly okay. It basically says that there exists a polynomial time or efficient knowledge extractor that can extract out the witness. So basically, he's saying that through these interactions, the prover has to provide enough information for some extractor to extract out the witness. So basically, it's saying that you have to have this witness, sort of. Yeah. Other than knowledge soundness, there's another notion or relaxation of zero knowledge properties, which is called witness indistinguishability. So what this means is that for any statements in the language, if there are two witnesses or multiple witnesses, any two witnesses that satisfy these NP relations, then the scripts, right, the scripts or the views between the prover and the verifier are similar if the prover has either witness one or witness two. So basically, the prover have either witness one or witness two, and it doesn't really, and the verifier couldn't tell the difference between the script when the prover has W1 or the prover has W2. He couldn't tell the difference. So that's the witness indistinguishability properties. Any questions so far? Oh yeah, sorry. I forgot to mention that the knowledge soundness are usually relevant when we are proving some zero knowledge proof of knowledge, right? That's where the proof of knowledge comes from. Zero knowledge proof is just the statement belonging to language, and the knowledge actually means that the prover has to have certain knowledge. Yeah. Okay. Just a gentle reminder. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Could you or somebody remind me what causes the blow up in trying to do a reduction to circuit satisfiability or one of the other NP problems?
Right. So you are referring to this one, right?
Yeah.
So usually when you express your NP statements, the circuit satisfiability is like, if you recall how the circuit looks like, it's like, for example, you have an input and you have different gates, can be a plus gate, can be maybe multiplication gate, whatever, right? And the NP statement is a very complicated statement. For example, you could say, for example, the plain text of X, this statement is a signature of M. And you have to reduce this whole simile, like very high level, something that you express in C program or, you know, whatever. And you have to compile it down to like a circuit, right? And that compilation, that reduction is very expensive.
So Dan, if you recall, right, if you're reducing between problems, right, you say, if I give you a solution to this problem, right, then, you know, it can be used to find a solution to some other problem, right? This sort of language of reductions. Dan, are you there?
Yeah.
So the problem is that the only restriction on these reductions from a complexity theory sense is that they're polynomial. And the polynomials might be just massive, right? So, you know, if I start with a problem that's like n nodes or sort of a, you know, n whatever instance problem, I don't want to particularly have to deal with, like, if I go through a reduction, I might get a problem that's of size like n to the fourth, right? And that's going to be prohibitively expensive for doing this kind of thing, right? If I start with like an 1,000 gate problem, you know, I end up with, you know, a quadrillion gate problem after this reduction or something like that.
Okay.
So it's just a parameterization issue. There are some problems that have like very tight reductions, but many do not.
Okay. If anybody has a, like a foundational reference to circuit sat.
I would say the Aurora Barak complexity theory textbook. is probably your best bet.
Got it. The Barack Obama complexity text.
Sorry. Let me find a link and I'll post it in chat.
Yeah, and feel free to go on and you can just post that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Hard. Is this kind of the right level of, I don't know.
Yeah, I think this is great. I mean, I think it's great to hear this from a practitioner perspective. And I think a lot of the practitioners on the call might understand more than necessarily me just blabbing about math.
Okay.
So okay. I think this is great. Thank you.
Cool, cool. All right. Yeah, so just to resume where we are at. Okay, so we mentioned the definition of the five definitions. And particularly, we can make some comparison between soundness and knowledge soundness. So, as we already said, that the knowledge soundness is a much stronger definition or more demanding definition. So, you not only have to, you know, if X doesn't belong to L, you could not convince the prover. And knowledge soundness says that on top of that, you have to the prover's script has to convince an extractor that you actually have the witness. Right? So you can derive soundness from knowledge soundness, but not the other way around. And there's a similar asymmetry between, between zero knowledge and witness indistinguishability. So witness indistinguishability is trivial if there's only one witness, right? If we have multiple witness, witness indistinguishability will make more sense. Because if we only have one, then it doesn't matter. Like, there won't be two different that for you to distinguish, for the verifier to distinguish. Zero knowledge is a stronger notion than witness indistinguishability. You can derive this way, but not the other way around. So in this GS paper, it first of all presents a witness indistinguishable non-interactive proof. And then under some special case, it derived the zero knowledge property which makes it zero knowledge and non-interactive. Okay. So it first presents something that only have the witness indistinguishability property, and then later on add more restrictions to get zero knowledge. All right, so that's that. That's the definition. And another thing that's important to know, I think, is that you could not simultaneously have perfect soundness and perfect zero knowledge, or statistic soundness and statistic zero knowledge. The idea comes from the question people posted, 20, 30 years ago, saying that is the SAT problem can be proven imperfect zero knowledge. So perfect zero knowledge means that you have perfect soundness and also perfect zero knowledge, right? That would seem very ideal, but people there are reduction of these statements to something that believes to be highly unlikely. So in order to relax this impossibility, there are two relaxations. One is either we have a computational soundness or we have computational zero knowledge, right? And if we have computational soundness, what that means is that if we go back to the soundness definition, we say that the prover, the cheating prover, couldn't convince verifier if the X is not true, right? If the statement is not true, right? What computational, what statistical soundness means is that even if the prover, the cheating prover, is computationally unbounded, which means that it has all the computation in the world, and it doesn't matter, because statistically speaking, it couldn't convince V with high enough probability. Whereas computational soundness is a much weaker property to have, which says that instead of an unbounded prover, what we are dealing with is a computationally bounded prover. So computationally bounded prover is usually what we call a PBT or probabilistic polynomial time prover. So which means that we're dealing with a weaker prover now. So the cheater couldn't like cheat unboundedly, unconditionally. So in a sense, computational soundness is a relaxation to statistical soundness or perfect soundness. Yeah, so that's one way. The other is computational zero knowledge, which is similar to what we just mentioned. So you remember this is zero knowledge, right? Zero knowledge properties, the definition of it is that the scripts produced by the simulators who doesn't have the witness is similar to the actual the script between the actual prover and the verifier. And computational zero knowledge means that the distribution between these two scripts are just computationally indistinguishable. If you imagine someone who's trying to distinguish these two, if this distinguisher is computationally unbounded, then he's able to actually distinguish. So he's actually able to learn that this script actually produced by a simulator, not by a real prover, right? So yeah, by the same token, that's what computational zero knowledge means. And often we call those systems that have computational soundness as argument system, and we call those who have computational zero knowledge properties as proof system. But in the current literature, I guess what I saw is that many people just use these two terms interchangeably, but you know, sometimes when you solve argument systems, that's what it means, right? So now you know, like, it means that it has computational soundness. So for statistical zero knowledge, which means that for unbounded distinguisher, he couldn't learn anything, so it has like an everlasting zero knowledge, right? Which means that if I present this proof, then throughout the universe, it wouldn't be, you know, no one would learn anything from it, right? The zero knowledge property will still hold, and that's very desirable, right? For example, like, I don't know, payments on Zcash, right? You wouldn't want anybody to know the secrets or my private key that I use to prove that I have this for a shielded transactions. So that's also what Zcash use. They use the argument systems, right? This is also more suitable for a less powerful prover. Whereas for computational zero knowledge proof, for proof systems, right, you have unconditional soundness, right? Okay. So anyway, that's kind of the two relaxation or two categories of arguments versus proof systems. Okay. So let's go back to the zero knowledge universe. Now we have all the definition, right? We have all the definitions. Usually, I think what's being used or what's most relevant to us is actually the SNARKs systems, the SNARKs proof systems that's being used in Zcash and other protocols. I don't know why or how the GS proof proposal came up, come to our agenda. I think someone proposed it because it was cited in the blueprint papers. But there are some limitations of the GS proof system that makes it less widely used in the blockchain world. So it's actually less relevant. So let's just break it down, the SNARKs, because we're still trying to figure out where the GS proof is in this ZK universe. So SNARKs stands for Succinct Non-Interactive Argument of Knowledge. I believe many of you already knew. So the important part is the succinct, right? The very desirable part is succinct, which means that for verification, it's supposed to be fast, right? It should be shorter than linear time. For proof size, hopefully that's also pretty succinct. For system like GGPR, I think it's usually the proof size is even constant. So that's very, very, very desirable. So irregardless of the complexity of the statement or the X that you're trying to prove, because the more complicated X is, the bigger the circuit will be if you compile down to a circuit, right? If you compile down to a circuit, that will be bigger. And what these SNARK system enables us to do is that even if the statement is very complex, the resulting proof is still short and succinct and very fast to verify. and that's very good. Now, if we compare, SNARKs with the title of the GS proof paper, you see the GS proof says that it's efficient, right? It's not exactly succinct, right? This efficient means that the proof generation is much more efficient than the previous zero knowledge proof system, and reason with the aforementioned reasons being that we don't have to reduce to circuit size viability, we only have to reduce it to group dependent language, which is quite native to a lot of the statements in crypto systems. But the verification in GS proof still involves quite expensive operation like pairings, and the proof size is not quite succinct. So in a sense, GS proof, in my personal opinion, wasn't that useful actually to the practitioner. It was used to design a lot of other group signatures and some other stuff. But for a blockchain use case, I guess it's quite limited. I could be wrong though. I think it's because of these trade-off that it makes. Right. So another thing that by the time I came to this point, a natural question that came up to my mind and that I'm me myself very curious about is SNARK itself. So how do we construct the SNARKs? Although this is totally relevant to the GS proof, I just wrote this down like 2 hours ago, so I guess we'll just have to go through it. Is that to familiarize with the SNARKs like constructions? There are usually two ways. The one is the traditional ways at the very beginning. I think like 20, 30 years ago, the academic literatures heavily used PCP or probabilistic checkup proof to construct a succinct arguments. And then later on, with the developments of new techniques, people try to use something that doesn't involve or doesn't explicitly use PCP. So let's take a look at the PCP way first. First of all, we have the MP relation. And this MP relation, like we just mentioned, can be a statement like C is a ciphertext of something, something, or a signature of something, something, right? Can be something complicated. And what we do is, first of all, we compile it down to some convenient representation. The reason why we want to compile it down is because all the proof system that we came up with doesn't directly deal with like arbitrarily complex MP relation or the statements, right? These are the things that we write in C program or any program, right? And these proof systems, they deal with something that's more native to the complexity theory and proof systems, which are like, for example, Boolean circuits, arithmetic circuits, and I think Hart covered a little bit on quadratic span program and quadratic arithmetic program, and also Earth already have R1CS, which is also a convenient representation, right? That the any MP relation can compile down to. And once we have this representation, there are like two separate steps for the PCP way, right? For the PCP way, there are two separate steps. The first is to construct a PCP or a probabilistic checkup proof that that has some zero knowledge properties. And these are called informational theoretical proofs. Reason being that these proofs would satisfy these properties regardless of the computational power. So they're sort of like even suitable for computationally unbounded proofers and verifiers. However, in realities, these are not efficient, and so we have to compile it down to proof systems or argument systems. And usually, what we do is we take some crypto compilers. We can take like multiple crypto compilers and compile down to an actual argument systems. And some example of this type of compilers are, we can have, like for example, we can assume some hardness, like a one-way function exists, or some we take some generic models like generic group models or Fiat-Shamir transform, and we can compile proofs in PCP and to a argument system or proof systems. Oh, by the way, this diagram is taken by from Isha's presentation directly. So intuitively, the idea is that we have some certain witness to prove X belongs to a language. And what we do is we have a probabilistic checkable proof encoding. So just a very quick intuition of probabilistic checkable proof. So I have a witness. This is my witness. And I can come up with a proof to prove this witness. And probabilistic checkable, right? Checkable means that I'm just choosing certain points. So these are called like point queries, right? I'm just asking to review some of these, a part of this proof, so that I don't have to just transmit the entire proof, so that it's much shorter. And then later on, you have like a linear PCP, which instead of asking certain points, you're taking a linear functions and doing a linear like pi equals times the query that give you the answer. Then you give back the answer. That was sort of the idea. So you don't have to query all the points on the proof. So that's how you do the PCP encoding. And later on, you have you will have accumulators that compile down all this expanding during the PCP encoding into a succinct proof. And these type of accumulators are like Merkle trees using a lot of hash functions, blah, 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 blah. And later on, you can prove that, for example, this opening queries actually belongs to, you will build a Merkle tree out of it, right? And you will provide the Merkle path to this opening queries. This proof usually will be this like Merkle root, right? So it's very succinct. Even if you have a lot of point queries, you have a lot of queries, PCP queries. But when you present the proof, you will just give a pretty short logarithmic log path plus the Merkle root. So and then later on, people realize that why are we expanding these witnesses and then try to shrink it using these accumulators. So they're trying to ask whether we can take some shortcuts, and that's the idea behind growth 10 proof systems and also GDPR. So what they do using the non-PCP way is that instead of having all of these like PCP encoding and then accumulating and compile it down, what they do is that they use something that's easier for the verification to do more efficiently. So they choose a different like representation. Like for example, quadratic spam program that is easy to directly derive zero knowledge arguments. So they basically get rid of this part to gain some efficiencies. Well, the idea is of course why they can do that. And intuitively, well, I haven't like read through a lot of those papers, so I couldn't give like a definitive answer. But intuitively, the way I understand it is that the reason why they're able to do this is through pre-processing. So basically, in order for you to be able to directly compile this QSP to zero knowledge argument systems, you have to do a lot of pre-processing. The pre-processing are done during the setups. So the setups is where you get all your the common reference stream, right? So in the common reference stream, because I think there's already implementation of some proof system in URSA, I think the API, you will have some approving key, approve key, and some verification key. And this this process of setups would be quite heavy. So that's why it's pre-processing. So it's before the proving even begins. So anyhow, that's enough of detour. Okay. So let's finally now we understand sort of, right? We sort of understand where GS proof stands. And yeah, like I said, I think the more relevant one is actually those SNARKs and SNARK systems for blockchain applications. But since we already talk about we're already here, so oh wait, it's already 55 minutes. Okay, well, I haven't even gotten to the main thing yet. anyhow, maybe I should pause and ask for questions. Anyone have any questions?
Well, I have a question, just not of you, but of Hart. Do we own this meeting time after 9 o'clock or after the top of the hour?
Somebody else take it over. Check.
Because if nobody else is taking it over, I would love for this presentation to continue.
It looks like we can continue. It looks like Caliper is the only thing on the calendar afterward. And they're on a different channel. So I don't see why not.
I don't know that people can stay on, but if the presentation continues so the recording could be there in a complete form, I think that'd be really valuable.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't think anything else is on. So yeah. So I don't see any reason why we can't continue if people want to stay on.
Yeah. Sorry for dragging this for too long.
No worries. This has been very good.
Yeah. Okay. With all those motivation stuff done, the next thing is the foundation or the basics for JS Proof, because JS Proof used binary maps. So let's just refresh our memory on binary maps. I stole all these slides directly from Growth presentation, you know. Okay, so the setup for binary maps there are two groups. Okay, let's use this one. The prime P is usually the size of the order of the cyclic group G1 and G2. So there are G1 and G2 are the source group, and there's the target group GT. And the generator for these source group are respectively G and H. And the binary map is a mapping from one element from the group one and one element from group two, and we map it to one element in. So this is G1, this is G2. Yeah, so you can have some G1, H1, and you take and you can get a elements in the target group. So that's a binary map. It's algebraic structures over groups. And a binary maps is non-degenerate. If the generator of the binary map of the two generators doesn't map to one, if it maps to one, then we will call it degenerate. Right. So the nice thing about binary map is that operations in the original source group can be taken out in the target group. So this will be something that we will see very frequently in the subsequent slides. The idea is that if we have the operation, right, this is using multiplicative notation, right? If the G belongs to group one, right? If we are doing multiplication explanation, so G to the power of alpha, it still belongs to G1, and H also belongs to G2, and H to the power of B belongs to G2, right? So if we do a multi-linear map on these two elements, it will be equals to we first map this element first, and then in the target group we raise it to the order of A and B, A times B, to another points, another elements in the group. Yeah, so that's the nice properties of bilinear structures. Right. Generic. Okay. Let's see. Oh yeah. So generic bilinear group operation. I guess I think this is less relevant, so we can just skip it for now. Well, so one of the thing that comes to mind is where does these bilinear group comes from? And usually they comes from like Q torsion points from an elliptic curve. And let's see. So this is usually this over here. Oh, okay, this is taken from slides from Bonnet. Sorry. In third BIU winter school. So there are these are called the Q torsion subgroup of the elliptic curve, and there are exactly Q to the power of two of number of them. And what does Q torsion points means? It means that any one of these points, right, if you raise it to the power of Q, then it would just fall back to the identity in a group. Like, let's say this is the identity in a group. Or if we're using elliptic curve, it means the point of infinity, right? So, for example, this would be the usually we call the base group, and it's over a prime field, and there will be more of these Q torsion points in the extension fields. And usually how you would imagine different groups, right? Let me back off. So in a bilinear map construction, you will have G1, G2, and GT. So for example, this base group is can be G1, for example, and you could draw a different a group, right? So this will be a group of Q points, and each point will also be a Q torsion points, which means that they have the order of Q. That's how you would represent them in a diagram. So it's nice to look at visually and to think about. So there are three types of bilinear maps. The first is that if we have a supersingular curve, we can derive a symmetric pairing. And I guess these are more technical details that doesn't really matter that much. But when you are reading the GS group paper, you will encounter this also. So it's good to know. So a symmetric pairing just basically means that G1 equals to G2. That's called symmetric pairing. So you have G1 equals G2 and map to GT like that, something like that.
Hey, Hart, where does hyperelliptic curves fit?
Sorry, hyperelliptic?
So I commonly see hyperelliptic curves where the group order is unknown, like as a possible replacement for RSA type stuff.
So you generally can't do pairings on those, right?
Okay, just double checking.
Right, so a pairing kind of doesn't make sense in a group of unknown order. I mean, I guess it can, it can exist, but like the elliptic curves for groups of unknown order usually come from isogenies, right? Mm-hmm. Or they're usually used in the context of isogenies. They don't come from isogenies. So all of these curves are known order groups, right?
Yeah.
So I believe what you're referring to is scenarios where there are unknown order groups, and that's like that's not really applicable here, and you can't do a lot of the things you want if the group order is not known. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's kind of a separate thing. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah, because I see the hyperelliptic curves as a proposal to replace some RSA base.
This is replacing like RSA stuff for like accumulators and like VDFs and stuff like that, right?
Correct. Yeah. But in those papers, I've never seen pairings. And so I assume it wasn't clickable, but just wanted to ask.
Yeah. So to my knowledge, we don't have any pairings over any efficient pairings over unknown order groups. So it kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. So anyway, yeah, but for here, yeah. Assume the groups are all order power of a prime, right?
I think we have efficient pairing over groups of composite orders.
Right, but not unknown.
Yeah, not unknown orders, yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks for the question. That's one type of pairings. And okay, according to Bonnet, he says that one nice thing about symmetric pairing, if you use symmetric pairing, the proof would be smaller because it's cleaner. You don't have to deal with two separate or distinct groups. However, asymmetric pairings where G1 doesn't equal to G2 is more general, but the proof itself would be a lot more hairier.
Not to mention, yeah. Some things aren't secure in type 1, like Poincaré-Sanders signatures are completely insecure in type 1 and type 2.
Well, there are different assumptions in the different groups, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like you can't have like SXDH, for instance, in symmetric pairings or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So if you need there's an interplay because like between sort of group size needed and assumption needed. So sorry for the diversion again.
Yeah, don't worry. Yeah, that's good clarification. The type 2 and type 3, the difference between the two is that if there's a trace map or a isomorphism, isomorphism from group 2 to group 1, then that's one type. And the other type is where you don't have such trace map. So I guess one of the implications of having this trace map would be DDH in the decision Diffie-Hellman problem in G2 would just be reduced down to that of G1. And that could be cause some problem in some constructions. So I guess, just to distinguish the two types, if there doesn't exist a trace map, for example, one particular special case would be just something that's vertical to G1, then there couldn't be like a non-degenerate trace map. And this is also something that BOS signatures use, I think. So those are the three types of bilinear maps. And so to jump back to the growth slides. So the group elements representation has a slightly different in size because the base group or the group one usually is smaller because it's over a prime field group two usually has group elements in the extension fields. So each element or each group elements would have slightly larger representation. So it's more costly to store or to use the elements from group two than to use something in group one. So that's kind of the order. And cost of operation. Yeah, multiplication in G1 is cheaper in G2 and cheaper than the target group. Exponentiation is also the same. Bilinear map is the most expensive among the three. So anything that happens within a group is relatively cheaper than if you want to do a mapping. Yeah, that's the cost of operation. Okay, so the equations, the satisfiability for the three types of equations. Remember that back then, I believe many of you, if you have skimmed through the paper, you would have seen this a lot. The pairing products, multi-exponentiation and quadratic equation. And remember, we have three types of questions, three questions posted earlier. First is why those three types, and also we want a concrete example. Luckily, in the presentation, we had one examples to internalize or to understand a little bit better on why these three, because they look pretty kind of abstract and very very general. Okay, so the example that given by growth is that okay. So let's try to express the statements in the form of these one of these or multiple of these equations, right? To make sure that this equation actually encapsulates what we want to express in a lot of crypto systems. So a statement like this is a ciphertext encrypting signatures on M, something like that, right? And a concrete instantiation would be like, for example, let's say we have a public key Y, and its algorithm ciphertext is UNV, right? So that's the encryption part. And then suppose that this encryption, right, it's encrypting something. It's encrypting a signatures, right? We're encrypting signatures. It's encrypting a signatures. This is the signatures, and this is the message, right? The signature has this form, where X is the private, W is the public key, and this X, small x over here, is the private key, okay, secret key, whatever. And the verification of this, this signature has to satisfy certain verification, and this is the verification equation. Right, and you know all these elements, you know the encryption ciphertext, and the public key belongs to group one, blah blah blah, and so the exercise or the is that we try to rewrite the statements as a set of the equations, right? So just to reiterate and to put it on a more visual representation, let's see, UNV is a ciphertext, and it belongs to G1. Wait, where am I? Yeah, UNV belongs to G1. Okay. And this is the signature. Wait. Let's just go. So the G, first of all, is the generator of group one. H is the generator of group two. And this, for the signatures, right, this Bonet-Boyle signatures, I have a secret key, and the public key lies in group two, right? X is just taken from integer group, and the signature lies in group one, and it has the form of G to the power of this thing, okay? So this exercise is basically trying to rewrite that. And first of all, let's try to rewrite these statements, right? This verification statements, because for us to rewrite all the statements, we basically have to satisfy two things, right? The first is a Bonet-Boyle signature. The other is to make sure that the ciphertext is correct, right? The first is the signature is correct. The second is the ciphertext is correct. So to express the signature is correct, right, we can move this thing, right? We can move the components on the right-hand side to the left-hand side, right? Assuming that F equals to G to the inverse of G, right? So we just move this thing to this side, and it will be one on the right-hand side. And the reason why we can take is because this is the property that we mentioned, right? We can move exponents from inside out and from outside in. So when we are moving something to the left hand side, we can move the exponent from outside into inside, and that's how we get this one. And if you look closely, this statements or this rewrite is pretty much can be encapsulated by the type one equation that are listed above. So this type one equation is the one that's over here. Okay, so let's take a look. Yeah, so for example, this one is the A and the B's, they are public components. Y's, X, they are private components. Private components as in private inputs. So for example, this signature will be a public inputs. This is also a public key. That's M where, okay, M is okay. This is also a public input. So this components here would be mapping to which one? Let's see. Give me a second. Let's see. X and Y's are public. Sorry, X and Y are public components. This will be mapping to this. Anyway, the idea is that this type one equation is like a generalization of something that's something as concrete as this one, as this signature verification equation. So that's the first part of it. The second part is the algama relation, right? So the algama encryption basically says what? Let's say it says that UNV is a ciphertext of the signatures, right? So we are encrypting the signatures, and so the algama encryption basically said, well, U is the G to the power of R, and V is Y to the power of R and times U. So that's just a standard algama encryption. And we can express this set of equations into this form. And this form is basically type two equation above. Yeah, so if we, for example, okay, this is a multiplicative notation. This is a additive notation. You could try to like replace, for example, A1 equals to one, that matches here, so on and so forth. Yeah, so the idea basically is that we can express something very concrete and something very relevant in cryptographic protocols like this, right? Cryptographic statements like this in the equations above. So now if we go back to the paper and we see these three types of equations, they will be like kind of less intimidating to us because we already seen an example of instantiation of these type of equations. All right. Yeah, there's the pairings, and there's the multiscalar multiplication, which is also shown above. And there's also the quadratic equations. Quadratic equation can also be used when you want to combine some of the statements above, right? For example, we want to say that we want to both satisfy the signature verification and the algama, right? There will be an and in between. Right, we already specified this thing over here, so it will be something like this form, and the AND or some other relation can be expressed using quadratic equations. Yeah, so right, right, with those kind of a setup, we can go into like a warm up proof systems. Maybe maybe do people want to ask for clarification? I think I probably should. Once again, the idea of having this equation expressed in this way is to encompass as many or all kinds of like multiscalar multiplication as possible, right? Right. So if you can see, if you can think of all the different combinations of A, so A is a constant, right? Y are private inputs. So you have a private input times a public inputs, and you have like wait, let's see, x. Oh yeah, so and also some from G1 and some from G2. So yeah, so for example, this one is from G2. So I guess the way I understand it is that it encapsulates all the different kind of combinations of like if certain cryptographic statements requires, you know, a secret. Requires like different combination of secret components and then public components. This is how they can this equation will be able to capture them all. So that's the idea. And same thing for pairing products and also quadratic equations. Hart, you want to add something?
No, yeah, thanks. This is good. You know, this is from the GS paper, and they're just presenting the kinds of equation, the kinds of constraints they can handle, right?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Well, we're 20 minutes over time. Okay, so wait, Hart, do you think I should go on, or do you think
How much more time do you think you have?
I don't know. I think still quite a bit. I didn't really, like I said, I didn't do a trial run, so I don't know how much.
No, that's all right. This has been interesting. Do you maybe want to continue next week then? I mean, I have to go at 9. I don't know what other people.
I think it will be a bit too long. I think what we can do maybe... because what comes after it would not be too different growth presentation. So we can maybe post the link for people to see. A lot of my own like inputs has been covered, I think, by far.
Yeah, no, it was great to. I think this is a very nice presentation. You know, it was great to see. You know. See your thoughts on this. And I think a lot of people on the call probably, you know, related to that sort of more than a traditional mathematical presentation. So I think that was great.
Right. Yeah. I apologize for all those stuttering and
no worries. It was quite coherent. Yeah. So I'll save the recording and upload it.
Okay. Sure.
And then, yeah, we can follow up over email on sort of, you know, the best way to go forward.
Okay, sure. All right. Yeah. Okay, then thanks everyone for, bearing with me for so long. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks everybody. Does anybody have any questions before we close? Brent, I know you're just dying to ask a question.
I want to say thank you. There's lots of questions, but I just need to rewatch the video. 5 or 6 more times.
All right. We can follow up by email as well. So, yeah. Thanks, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording.